Information, please. Presented each week at this time by Canada Dry, famous the world over for its fine beverages. Wake up, America. Time to stump the experts and enjoy a glass of cool, refreshing Canada Dry ginger ale. Every week at this time, Canada Dry acts as host to an inquisitorial nation and supplies four experts for it to badger. Here's how it goes. For every question we use, whether or not it's answered correctly, the sender gets $5. And if your question stumps our board of experts, you not only get $10 more, but in addition, you receive a complete 24-volume set of the current Encyclopedia Britannica. Mind you, this is only if your question stumps our board of experts. Our editorial staff may reword your question a trifle. Don't worry about it. Whenever there is a duplication of questions, Information Please uses the one that was received first. All questions become the property of Information Please and should be addressed to Canada Dry, 1 Pershing Square, New York City, or in Canada, Canada Dry, Toronto. And now, may I present our master of ceremonies, Mr. Clifton Fadiman, literary critic of the New Yorker magazine. Mr. Fadiman.
Ladies and gentlemen, we take a good deal of pride in the fact that this is a completely informal and unprepared program, and we say that without qualification. Now, before we go ahead tonight, Information Please has an announcement of world-shaking political importance to make. 2 weeks ago, some of you may remember, we ruled that Chingachgook, who is the Indian hero of Fenimore Cooper's Last of the Mohicans, was eligible to run for the presidency. Now, that opinion has been basely challenged in the public prints and elsewhere. We secured the best legal advice that we could, and we stand by our ruling. In fact, we'll go further. From this historic moment on, ladies and gentlemen, Chingachgook is our candidate for president. We urge all Information Please fans to form Chingachgook for President clubs. Cast your ballot for Chingachgook, a 100% American. And now let us return to our experts. The board this evening comprises our two inexhaustible regulars, Franklin P. Adams and John Kieran, and two guests. One is an old friend of Information Please, Christopher Morley, whose play, Soft Shoulders, has been breaking records at the Mill Pond Playhouse in Long Island. The other, in addition to being a member of a fairly well-known family, is a motion picture producer, Mr. James Roosevelt, who has come to New York for the opening of his first production, the much-awaited and discussed picture, Pastor Hall. Now remember, listeners, for each question that's missed, Canada Dry rings up $10. And that's paid out to the sender, plus 24 volumes of the latest edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica. We're off with a question that comes to us from Mrs. C.S. Uphile of Hackensack, New Jersey, and which was perhaps propounded by her in honor of our guest of honor this evening. I'm going to ask you to name a child of each of these pairs of parents, very famous parents. Get 3 out of 4. Here's the first pair. The mother was Winona, granddaughter of the moon, and the father was Mudjikewis. Mr. Curran.
Hiawatha.
Hiawatha, yes. That's 100% from our Indian expert, Mr. Curran. Now, in the second case, the mother was Black Mumbo, and the father was Black Jumbo, Mr. Adams.
Little Black Sambo.
Little Black Sambo, that's right. Now, in the third case, the mother was Lady Alice. The father was John Clayton, Lord Greystoke. That is one person, not two, gentlemen, lest there be any misapprehension. John Clayton, Lord Greystoke. The very famous son of that pair of parents, the most famous so far. You don't know, gentlemen? Mr. Morley.
Was it Black Beauty?
Black Beauty. No, it was not Black Beauty. It's a wild and daring guess. The answer is Tarzan. Tarzan.
I think that was a pretty good guess.
That wasn't bad. That wasn't bad, Mr. Morley. Tarzan. Let's get this one wrong. I'll have to get the next one right. The mother was Mrs. Kearney. The father, the Finn.
Should be Mickey, but I don't
know. Thank you, Mr. Rover. Should be, but Mr. Kieran?
Well, that's a racehorse.
It is.
Sense, because the Finn was a famous sire on the turf.
That's right. And it's perfectly obvious that the mother, Mrs. Kearney, was the mother.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, I know it wasn't Man of War.
All right. That eliminates Man of War.
It's an old, I think it's not a very recent...
Arrival?
Arrival, no. No, I don't know what horse.
Would you just guess for us, Mr. Kearney?
Too many good horses to stand well, their names about.
It is a racehorse, as Mr. Kieran sagely suggests. He doesn't know the name. It's the famous racehorse Zev. Z-E-V. I'm afraid we have to lose $10, though we got half of the last question correct. That sends a set of the Britannica and $10 to Mrs. Upile for a very interesting question, and sends us on to the next one, coming from John A. Carroll of Philadelphia. This is a question about politics, recent politics. Who made the nominating speeches for the Democratic and Republican presidential nominees at the recent conventions? Now, that we have four parts here. We have to get three out of four. Suppose we start with Mr. Roosevelt.
The Democratic convention, Lister Hill, senator from Alabama.
Placed who in nomination?
Placed Franklin D. Roosevelt.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
In the Republican convention, I don't know how to pronounce the gentleman's name, but Representative Halleck, I think, from Indiana, nominated Mr. Wendell Willkie.
That is quite correct. That gives us two out of four. Now, Mr. Adams, would you continue the story? Who made the keynote speech of the Republican and Democratic parties? There's two parts to this. Who made the keynote speech of the Republican and Democratic Party? Well, we'll have Mr. Roosevelt again on this one.
The keynote speech for the Democratic Party was made by Senator Bankhead. The Speaker Bankhead, not Senator Bankhead.
Representative Bankhead. Speaker Bankhead.
Of
what state?
Of Alabama.
Of the great and sovereign state of Alabama. And how about the Republican?
The Republican keynote speech, I think, was made by Representative Martin of Massachusetts.
That, I'm afraid, is an error. Mr. Adams, Pat.
Herbert Hoover.
No, I don't think that was right, Mr. Adams, either. The keynote speech, Mr. Roosevelt?
By Governor Stassen.
Yes. Governor Harold Stassen of Minnesota for the Republican. That gives us three out of four, which is all we were required to get. Governor Harold Stassen in Minnesota made the keynote speech for the Republicans. Mrs. J.A. Killian of Englewood, New Jersey, sends in a question about islands that have figured prominently in literature or history. Get two out of three if you can. First, give the name and location of the island on which the Swiss family Robinsons found shelter after their ship was wrecked. Now, it's a very famous story that's recently been transmuted into the medium of what, Mr. Roosevelt, I believe you call the silver screen. Mr. Kieran.
I never could find where that island was on any map because they have the queerest conglomeration of birds, beasts, and reptiles on there.
Yeah.
It never was found on not only any island, but any continent in the world. Well, any one continent in the world.
Well, that settles the reputation of the Swiss family Robinson, I guess, forever. You never found the island on the map, Mr. Kieran.
I couldn't even guess where it was.
Mr. Morley, do you want to guess?
I have a sort of feeling that if you drew a triangle from Ceylon to Sumatra to Madagascar...
I'm lost.
It would be within that triangle.
A triangle from where to where?
Ceylon to Sumatra to Madagascar.
No runs.
It would be about at the...
possibly no errors either, Mr.
Pacific center of gravity of that triangle.
Well, what ocean would that be in? Name, pick an ocean.
The Indian Ocean.
The Indian Ocean. Well, it would be near New Guinea. Off the coast of the Dutch East Indies. Is that in that triangle? I'm terrible on triangles.
No, it wouldn't be far away.
Well, I think it would be reasonably near, Mr. Morley. I'm going to count that correct and ask you, by the way, who wrote The Swiss Family Robinson, Mr. Morley?
Pastor Weiss.
Yes, that's right. I guess very few people remember the name. How do you spell it?
W-Y-S-S.
That's perfectly correct. Name the island to which Claudius sent Hamlet when he wanted to get rid of him. This is another question about islands. Miss Curran.
Well, he sent him toward England, but he didn't get there.
He didn't get there. I should have said toward which.
Well, that's all right. I said it for you.
England is right. Thank you, Miss Curran. That gives us two out of three. See what you can do with the third. What island was the first land to be touched by Columbus on his first voyage of discovery? Mr. Roosevelt.
I think it was the island of San Salvador.
Yes, quite right. In the Caribbean or Caribbean Sea. Yes. Take your choice. Do you know what the island is now known as, Mr. Roosevelt? Doesn't have the name San Salvador, or at least it's known as another island, Mr. Morley?
Dominica.
No, I think you're thinking of Salvador in Central America, which is another Salvador. We mustn't mix our Salvadors. It's the it's known as Watling Island, W-A-T-L-I-N-G, Watling Island on the map.
Bell Watling?
I beg your pardon, a different one. R. Burke of Cincinnati sends this one in. We're going to quote headlines using initials instead of full names. To what news event does each refer? Get two out of three. W succeeds W. That's a recent news event. I'll give you merely the initial. W succeeds W. Those are people, of course. The initials represent the initials of the last name. W succeeds W. Mr. Adams.
I would guess that might be the president of Commonwealth and Southern. The new one.
That gives us one W. Oh, you think that his name is also begins with W?
Might be. That's the only.
Would be a little monotonous. No, I don't think so. No. Now the answer is that Mr. Claude R. Wickard is to succeed Henry Wallace as Secretary of Agriculture. That gives us two W's and gives us one wrong. How about this one? G buys R. G buys R. This is very difficult. Very difficult. I'm sorry, gentlemen. Here it is. Clark Griffith, who is the owner of the Washington Senators, buys Sherrod Robertson, his own adopted son, from the Charlotte baseball team in the Piedmont League. That is a pretty tough one to get, I think. Now, how about this? J may replace H. J may replace H. This is a recent headline. Quite recent, I believe, in the last 4 or 5 days. J may replace H. Well, you gentlemen are not very good on initials. Jesse Jones has been invited to replace Harry Hopkins as Secretary of Commerce. That makes a fact that many of us have noted in the paper. I don't know how easy I can make these for you. IP nominates C, Mr. Adams. What would that mean to you? IP nominates C. Mr. Curran.
Information, please. Nominates Chingachgook.
That's right. Don't forget, ladies and gentlemen. Well, that gives us a free wrong out of three, and sends a set of the Britannica and $10 to Mr. Burke of Cincinnati, Ohio. Here's one from Florence Rubenstein of Bayonne, New Jersey. What character in movies or novels was troubled by each of these problems? Get 2 out of 3. The first character was troubled with the problem of marrying off 5 daughters. Who was that? Marrying off 5 daughters. Mr. Morley.
Father Dion.
Well, I'm thinking of fictional characters. Perhaps sometimes, at some time or other, Mr. Leon has wished he were a fictional character. But this is a character in a movie or a novel. It's Mrs. Bennet in Pride and Prejudice. Mrs. Bennet in Pride and Prejudice. How about a character who was troubled by the dominating memory of a first wife? This is in a recent movie or novel. Mr. Morley.
Rebecca.
Well,
Rebecca was the previous.
Yes, and who was the... Mrs. De Winter, who was troubled by... That's right, right. Who was troubled by the degeneration of an overindulged child? This, again, is a more or less recent movie and a best-selling novel of perhaps 3 years ago. Well, perhaps that's a rather hard one. It's in a novel called My Son, My Son by Howard Spring. William Essex is the father of Oliver Essex, who gives him a lot of trouble. I think we got 2 out of 3 wrong there. That spends a set of the Britannica and $10 to Miss Rubenstein. The outside audience is doing very well this evening, somewhat better than the experts. Here's one that is a very simple question in arithmetic, gentlemen. You who get no pens or paper or pencil to help you out. Dorothy A. Keller of Los Angeles sends this one in. Add the number of wives that Bluebeard had. Got that? To the wives of Henry VIII. Add the number of wives the man from St. Ives had, and the number of husbands of the wife of Bath. Total number of wives and husbands, gentlemen. An appalling number. Did I go too quickly for you? That was for Mr. Adams.
Too uxorious.
It is a pretty uxorious question. How do you make it? Mr. Curran, did you get any of them? The number of wives Bluebeard had?
I thought he had about 9, but I'm just guessing.
No, he had 7.
7.
He had 7. Henry VIII had how many wives? Mr. Morley?
5.
No. Be fair. 6. Yes. Mr. Roosevelt, I think, was going to say 6, and Mr. Adams did say it. Now, the man from St. Ives... Do you remember the nursery rhyme? I met a man, Mr. Kieran.
I think he had 7.
That's quite right, Mr. Kieran and Mr. Adams. That's 7. And the number of husbands of the wife of Bath, a character that you'll find in Chaucer's Canterbury Tales. Number of husbands, 5. She had 5 husbands.
I hope one after the other. That would make a total of 25 husbands and wives altogether, and a total of $10 going to Miss Dorothy A. of Los Angeles, plus a set of the Titanic.
Now, let me see. When an irresistible question meets an immovable expert, something is bound to happen. As a matter of fact, it's happened four times. And Canada Dry has lost $40. And so, for a moment, Mr. Milton Cross.
That delight of the busy man, the long weekend, lies just ahead. And from here, it looks mighty attractive. And Canada Dry beverages are going to make this three-day holiday even more attractive. When you hole out at the 18th or win match point, a frosted glass of refreshing Canada Dry ginger ale is going to slide down very easily. And when you come tingling from the shower, it's going to be a great pleasure to have someone hand you a tall glass tinkling with ice and sparkling with Canada Dry water. Canada Dry's excellent club soda brings out the flavor of your favorite drink, enlivens it, and makes it last longer. No matter where you spend the weekend, seashore, mountain, or apartment, just remember that Canada Dry ginger ale and sparkling water will help you enjoy those leisure moments.
Thank you, Mr. Cross. Our stopwatch caught you in exactly 50 seconds. And now we'll start the second half of the program this evening with a question from Mimi L. Yannis of Brooklyn. Give the titles and authors of four books that indicate some form of bodily movement. For example, She Stoops to Conquer by Oliver Goldsmith would have a reference to some bodily movement in it. Give me four other titles if you can, gentlemen. Old books, plays, movies. Mr. Morley.
Coming Through the Rye.
Coming Through the Rye is a very good one, yes. Who wrote it?
Robert Burns.
Is that right, Mr. Chair?
No, Joanna Bailey.
I'm not sure who it was that wrote it, but Coming Through the Rye is certainly a good title, indicating bodily movement. That gives us one. Well, think of all the bodily movements. Mr. Kieran.
The Jumping Frog of Calaveras County by Mark Twain.
I think that would be a swell one, Mr. Kieran. Very good. That gives us two. Here we go. Well, now let me see. At the risk of Mr. Adams.
Run, Sheep, Run.
Run, Sheep, Run. Yes, that is a novel of about 7 or 8 years ago. That's right. That gives us three. The Wild Duck, Mr. Adams, would you throw me out if I mentioned that
one? The Wild Duck, it's a poem by Mayfield.
I know what I said, Mr. Kieran.
All right, Little Red Riding Hood.
Little Red Riding Hood. Oh, riding, very good. Yes, that's fine. That gives us four. Good enough. Lawrence S. Kennison of Brooklyn sends this one in. Four men now holding prominent public office in Washington have been nominated in the past for vice president, but not elected. Name three of them. Four men who are now holding office in Washington have in the past been nominated for vice president, but not elected. Name three, if you can, out of the four. Mr. Roosevelt.
Well, I can start. Senator Wheeler was once nominated for vice president.
That is quite right. In 1924, I believe, on the progressive ticket, was
ticket
it?
On the progressive
ticket. That's quite right. Senator Burton K. Wheeler of Montana. That gives us one. And Mr. Morley.
Mr. Knox, I think.
Mr. Knox, now Secretary of the Navy. Of the Navy. Ran for vice president in 1936 on the Republican ticket. That gives us two. Now, if we can get one more, we don't have to send $10 to Mr. Kennison, who is no doubt eagerly awaiting his set of the Britannica. I must say that...
Is Mr. John W. Davis holding office now?
I don't think so, Mr. Morley. Mr. Roosevelt?
Was Senator Johnson of California once nominated?
Yes, Senator Hiram W. Johnson was nominated for vice president on the progressive ticket in 1912.
But I know somebody else who was nominated for vice president and has not been elected.
Who is that?
Henry Wallace.
Well, that is perfectly true. That's perfectly true. That would give me a perfect score. I hadn't thought of that, Mr. Adams. That's a tricky one.
I think that we might mention the president, vice president.
Thank you, Mr. Roosevelt. I was wondering when that was... who did you say?
Mr. John Nance Garner, who is holding high office in that office.
He was elected.
Oh, but he was elected.
He has been elected.
Twice. These people don't have to be...
They were not elected. Okay. I must say, Mr. Roosevelt, that your memory is not only slightly faulty, but it is extremely filial. The other one is Franklin D. Roosevelt, who ran for vice president on the Democratic Party in 1920. Was not elected as vice president, but later on did fairly well for himself. How did you happen to forget that, Mr. Roosevelt?
Well, I was quite young at the time.
Yes, of course. You were.
Forget it.
What a nice big boy you've grown up today, Mr. Roosevelt. Well, that gives us five out of four, thanks to Mr. Adams and myself. Francis Stillman of New York City sends this one in. This is a Shakespearean question, gentlemen, and it is not easy. Get three out of four. In what Shakespearean plays do the following stage directions occur? This is my idea of a tough question. The first stage direction is simply exit pursued by a bear. In what play does that stage direction occur? Mr. Kieran.
I think that's in Winter's Tale.
That's absolutely right, Mr. Kieran. Though how you remembered it, I haven't the slightest idea. It's in Act 3 of The Winter's Tale.
He's found killed afterwards, torn by the bear, too. That's the old gentleman who was to carry the little babe out and lose it.
That's right. Now, how about this one? The attendants part them, and they come out of the grave. That stage direction occurs in what play? Mr. Morley.
Hamlet.
In Hamlet, yes. The third, I beg pardon, this is a three-part question, not a four-part question. Clock strikes. That is the only very short stage direction. Clock strikes. Mr. Kieran.
I think that's in several plays, but the one that you have there may be Julius Caesar.
That's right. That's right, Mr. Kieran. That's right. Mr. Kieran, what made you think that was the one that I had in mind?
Well, because that's when Brutus is having a long soliloquy.
Yeah.
I believe, and, I don't know, it just stuck and came first to my mind.
Well, there's another reason, Mr. Kieran, and that is that would a clock be absolutely
striking?
Oh, well,
it's an anachronism. Yes. It's one of the famous anachronisms of Shakespeare.
Yes, a clock wouldn't be apt to be striking way back in Julius Caesar's time. Shakespeare cared very little for those things and done pretty well despite it. What did they have striking in those times?
They used hourglasses and water clocks and things like that.
Water glasses, water clocks
and hour glasses, sundials. And
they make any noise, though?
Not much.
No alarm at all. Oh, well, that gives us 3 out of 3, thanks to Mr. Kieran and Mr. Morley. Paul M. Lyon, Lieutenant of the United States Navy, retired of Washington, sends this one in. Get 3 out of 4 if you can. What ranks in the Army correspond to the following ranks in the Navy? First, a captain. What rank in the Army corresponds to that? Mr. Kieran.
I think that's a colonel.
That's quite right. Colonel is right. Now, an ensign. The corresponding rank, Mr. Roosevelt, do you have your hand up?
Yes. Junior lieutenant in the Army would rank to be as an ensign.
Second lieutenant. Second lieutenant, that's right. Now, a rear admiral. The corresponding rank, Mr. Kieran?
A rear admiral would be a brigadier general.
A major general.
The ranks are not absolutely parallel all the way up. A rear admiral in the Navy, I believe, is a step above a captain. Now, the step above a colonel in the Army is brigadier general.
But it could also be a major general.
It could also be a
major general. Very good. Now, how about a lieutenant commander? Lieutenant commander, the corresponding rank in the Army would be? Mr. Kieran again.
A lieutenant commander in the Navy would be a major.
A major. That's quite right. Well, that gives us 4 out of 4. Now I think we'll have time for this next one at least. Mary Conlon of Cambridge, Massachusetts sends it in. Get 3 out of 4. That's a rather complicated question, gentlemen. It's about famous trials from equally famous books. In what books do the trials occur? In the first case, it's a trial in which the French defendant was aided by testimony to the effect that he had previously been tried for his life in England. In what book does that famous trial occur? And whose trial was it? It's a very difficult question, I think. It's the trial of Charles Evremond, called Darnay. Charles Darnay is his other name, in Dickens's novel, A Tale of Two Cities. Remember it now? I'll come right back to you, Mr. Adams, with a rush. That gives us one wrong. Have to get the next 3 right. In this case, it's a trial in which the winning lawyer took in place of a fee only a pair of gloves and a ring. Obviously a work of fiction. Gentlemen, Mr. Adams.
It wouldn't be the Merchant of Venice.
Yeah, oh, yes, indeed. That's quite right, Mr. Adams. It's Portia who took from Bassanio the ring and the pair of gloves. That gives us 2 to go. A trial which the judge opens by asking the jury to consider their verdict. Mr. Kieran.
That's the trial of the Knave of Hearts, I believe, for stealing the tarts in Alice in Wonderland.
That's quite right, Mr. Kieran. And fourth and last, a trial at which the defendant is saved by the unexpected testimony of a small boy. The unexpected testimony of a small boy.
There's one of those in Mark Twain.
Which book?
Either Tom Sawyer or Huckleberry Finn.
Which one?
Huckleberry Finn.
Tom Sawyer.
I'm awfully sorry. I really ought to give you that, Mr. Chairman, but I'm afraid we'll have to send $10 to Mary Conlon and a set of the Britannica. But we're waiting to hear from you.
A few weeks ago, the entire nation was suffering from one of our worst heat waves. Ocean and mountain resorts set new attendance records as people tried to escape the results of that ever-climbing thermometer. Then, as always, Canada Dry Ginger Ale played a big part in these efforts to beat the heat. For ginger ale is really one of the most refreshing and thirst-quenching of beverages. And Canada Dry, made from the finest of ingredients, blended by experts under a formula that defies imitation, is ginger ale at its refreshing, wholesome best. So for pure, wholesome goodness, for a gingivating lift on all occasions, no matter what the weather, drink Canada Dry, the champagne of ginger ales. I am reading the following announcement at the request of the United States Department of Justice. The Alien Registration Act requires all aliens to register between August 27th and December 26th, 1940. Anyone who is not a citizen and who fails to register will be liable to fine or imprisonment or both. The government is confident that all loyal aliens will cooperate by registering as early as possible. Ask your postmaster for a sample form of the registration questions and remember the date, August 27th.
This evening, Canada Dry has lost a total of $50 plus 5 sets of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Thank you, Mr. Morley. Thank you, Mr. Roosevelt, for joining the party tonight. Next week, Mr. Adams, Mr. Kieran, and Mr. Levant will be on hand. And as our guest, we're happy to announce Henry Beetle Huff, editor of the Vineyard Gazette and author of the current bestseller, Country Editor. Remember, for every question we use, whether or not it's answered correctly, the sender gets $5. And if your question stumps our board of experts, you not only get $10 more, but in addition, a complete 24-volume set of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Remember, send your letters with questions and the correct answers to Canada Dry, 1 Pershing Square, New York City.